Campus FM presents a talk in the series Rediscovering the Grandmaster's Palace, entitled Deeds and Misdeeds at the Palace. This talk is delivered by Judge Giovanni Bonello and is organized by the Office of the President.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends. I didn't choose the subject of this lecture. If it turns out to be the wrong subject, blame Salvatore. He chose it for me. I didn't have a say. Well, the subject is deeds and misdeeds of the palace. I'm sure you're looking forward more to the misdeeds than to the deeds. Deeds are usually so boring. So, what you will be hearing today is gossip, slander, spite, what the news of the world would have been had it existed 400 years ago. We have to put the whole subject in perspective. The Order of St. John was a monastic order, an old monastic order which had had some great moments in its history, came to Malta in 1530, and when it came to Malta, it was in the first phase. It was still more or less in the monastic phase. But the order remained in Malta for 270 years, give or take. And in 270 years, things change. Customs change, morals change. And this is reflected in the Grand Masters. Although the subject is not the sex life of the Grand Masters, there will be a bit of that too. And the Grand Masters, following this trend of evolution that went on not only in Malta but throughout Europe, can roughly be divided in two types. Those Grand Masters before wigs and the Grand Masters after the wigs. I'm saying this because the wig was definitely a cut-off between the monastic time of the orders and the more sumptuous, more lavish, more worldly times of the order. Probably the first Grand Master to wear a wig was Grand Master Perellos, and before him, of course, they were human beings, and they had their failings. But with Perellos, from Perellos onwards, with some laudable exceptions, the way forward was the way down. We're talking of the palace. The palace was the residence of the Grand Masters. It was the court of the Grand Masters. And when I say court, it was also the criminal court of the Grand Masters. So all these stories I will be delving in, most of them happened here, just here, because whenever a Grand Master, a knight, went the wrong way, he was hauled in front of the criminal justice of the order, and the trials were held here in this palace. We have to keep in mind that those were very violent times. When I say violent, I really mean today, by comparison, we live in a very peaceful society. We're always saying, oh, the good old times, how bad we're becoming, knife crime all the time. There are no statistics about the population, but there are plenty of statistics about the community of knights. In Malta, there were always between 400 and 600 knights. There were, for this very tiny community, about one murder a week. It is recorded that there was a murder or an attempted murder roughly 50 times a year, which makes once a week. So we have to keep in mind that. Why was there this violence? Of course, there isn't an easy answer. There isn't one answer. But the predominant reason is probably because the system of the administration of justice just didn't work. You got no justice from the state, so you resorted to private justice. vendetta. Offenses had to be washed in blood, either with duels or with commissioned murders. That is one thing we have to keep in mind. Another thing that we have to factor in is the huge amount of prostitutes that there were in Malta. Every visitor to Malta noted and was amazed at the huge number of prostitutes. If one has to believe Karazi, who maybe was exaggerated a bit, Karazi says that 2 out of 3 Maltese women live full-time or part-time on prostitution. It's a shocking statistic. We don't have to believe it to the last digit, but certainly Karaz is not the only one who makes this remark about the huge number of women of ease of virtue that run around. So you have on the one side 500 celibate knights and a huge horde of prospective predators on the virtue of those knights. And the result was what it is. Many of the knights, we remember that they took the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. That was in theory, but most of them were young men, second or third sons in a family, which were thrown into the order because the family could not afford to keep them. They were shunted into the Order of Malta without a vocation, without any real sense of belonging to a monastic order. They were forced there, and surrounded as they were by this huge amount of pleasure givers, the result is that many of them broke the vows. The young ones, the middle-aged ones, even the very old ones. When I mentioned violence, there's one phenomenon that is not easily explained. Today, if a person is committed to prison for a serious crime, the stigma remains. He's out of prison, but the social stigma of having been a criminal will follow him or her for the rest of their lives. It doesn't seem to have been like that in the order or in the times of the order. Knights which were convicted of really awful crimes rose in the hierarchy of the order. It's as if the moment that they had paid the debt to society, the day they were out of prison, the career started without a hiccup. Is that better or is it worse than it is today? I'm not here to judge, but it is certainly noticeable that many of the people who had a brilliant career in the order had a very turbulent initiation in the order, including grandmasters. So we can perhaps go through a few of them. I think it's best to start with the most famous grandmaster of all, Grandmaster Jean de Valette, a great person, undoubtedly a person who had an enormous personality which showed through the terrible times of the siege. Undoubtedly a great man. But today we're not here to talk about greatness, we talk about here about weaknesses. And one of his weaknesses was his violence. At least twice, de Valette was condemned for crimes of violence. In one of them where he used violence in the Latin words, maximo scandalo, with the greatest of scandals. On another person, he was condemned for 4 months imprisonment in the Guva. Now, the Guva was a horrible place. It was a well. Basically, you're put in the bottom of a well. There is no escape route at all. Your bread and water is just hung down on a rope, and you live there at the bottom of this well. And the valet, for this offense, was condemned to 4 years, 4 months solitary confinement in the Guva, and then to 2 years exile in Tripoli. He came back, and this did not affect his career at all. We all know that eventually he rose and rose and rose until he became Grand Master. There was another criminal investigation against the valet. It wasn't held here because at the time the Grand Masters lived in Birgu. There was another criminal for a very hazy offense. The facts are not very clear. He was accused of having smuggled into Malta, a Negro, legal immigrant. And we don't know much about it, except that he was tried and condemned. De Valette had his moments of weakness too. After the Great Siege, there was a bad decline. He became totally paranoid. He had this persecution mania. He arrested and imprisoned anybody who criticized him. That was the first wave. The second wave was that he arrested and imprisoned all those who criticized him for having arrested and imprisoned. So that was a bit sad. But the saddest thing to De Valette was that he had a daughter who he loved enormously. We know that it was his daughter because the historian says that he had held her at baptism for very special personal reasons, and that meant that it was his illegitimate daughter. And this girl, Isabella Guasconi, was reputed to be the most beautiful girl in Malta, De Valette's daughter. She married a Florentine noble of lesser rank, Stefano Bonaccorsi, and De Valette had always this special rapport with his daughter. One day, Bonaccorsi believed, rightly or wrongly, that his wife was cheating on him, and he stabbed her to death a number of times. He murdered her, escaped with all her jewels. Being the daughter of the Grand Master, she would have had a nice hoard of jewels. And this is where the Grand Master went berserk. He did crazy things. For example, he convened a council of the order with urgency. Now why? I mean, the council of the order only dealt with affairs pertaining to the order. The council of the order met when either the victim was a knight or the suspect murderer or criminal was a knight. Otherwise, it had no reason at all to convene. But Grandmaster De Valette, struck with great grief, convened the council, and made draconian measures to capture the murderer of his daughter. He did not succeed. This man disappears completely from Malta and from history. And what we know is that the historian says that this was a terrible blow to the Grand Master. He declined into an insurpassable depression, melancholy, and he shortly later died. The best historian of the order attributes the Grand Master's death to the murder of his daughter. And another Grand Master who is well known, again, a very unfortunate life, Lacassière, who was basically a good Grand Master, but he was very severe, and he had a big rebellion on his hands. Lacassière ended up dethroned, mostly because he had banned the presence of the mistresses of the knights from Valletta. He said, you can stay outside Valletta, but please don't sully the new capital city with your presence. And a number of knights couldn't take that. They revolted. They had other reasons, but basically that was the reason why there was so much discontent against him, and deposed him. What is sad is that this old man, who meant well, was taken from the palace here to St. Angelo, imprisoned there, and the historian says that all the way from here to St. Angelo, he was jeered by the prostitutes. He had this very sad exit through the streets of Valletta, being made fun of by his greatest enemies. Lacassière was also, in a way, a bit paranoid. He accused one who's probably my ancestor, a certain Antonio Bonello, of trying to poison him. He had Bonello tortured, he had him tried, he had him pilloried, but Bonello never admitted that he was in any way involved in any plot to poison the Grand Master. And eventually he was sort of rehabilitated. Verdal is another rather tragic figure. Verdal was a Frenchman who started his reign just after the huge troubles of the rebellion against Lacassière, and he asked for the Pope to have special disciplinary powers to impose his will on the recalcitrant members of the order. But he himself had also been tried a number of times for violent behavior. In 1577, he was involved in a criminal prosecution where he was tried for taking part in a violent brawl. Slightly later, he came to the attention of the inquisitor for seditious speech. 1581, he was actually investigated for heresy. The only Grand Master who became a cardinal was actually tried for heresy. And there are many remnants, relics of Verdal in this palace. If you came out from the spiral staircase, you will have noticed the wolf. There is a wolf on every window. The principal decoration is the wolf. Why the wolf? Because Verdal was Lubin Verdal, which means the wolf. And his coat of arms and his motto was all wolf-oriented. Mentioning the staircase, let me get rid of a legend. You know, the staircase is particularly low. The staircase is not a normal staircase. And a large number of legends have sprung about this staircase. Why? Because the Grand Masters or the senior knights wanted to be carried in their sedan chairs. Why? Because knights wanted to come up and down on horseback. Why? Because with their heavy armors, they couldn't negotiate different type of steps. It's not true at all. The reason is, as usual, much more down to earth. There are the papers which exist where the Grand Master, Verdal, who suffered terribly from the gout, begged the architect to make the steps as low as possible because he could not raise his knees enough to be able to negotiate higher steps. So all the legends, all the romance about cavaliers prancing up and down those stairs on horseback, those are nonsense. It's just because he suffered from the gout. And Verdal's gout is the center of another nasty episode. A number of knights reported him to Rome, the scandal of this Grand Master locking himself up in his room, the room was somewhere there, with other knights and gambling. They actually locked themselves up to gamble. So, not only gambling, he was accused of breaking the fast, of not believing enough in the power of relics, a number of terribly serious offenses. And the Pope from Rome sent this list of charges to Verdal. What do you have to say about them? And he wrote a very beautiful letter. He said, Your Highness, I'm an old man. I suffer from the gout. And the only way I can relieve the pain, the discomfort, is that I meet a number of old knights and we gamble, but only for a few pennies. We never gamble for any large sums of money. He says, and we never swear. Gambling and swearing were always considered to go hand in hand. He said, no, we just gamble for a little money on doctor's orders. Please forgive me. A true story, recorded and documented about Verdal, is about the Column of Fame. Up to some time ago, just across the palace in the main guard, there was a column with a wolf on the column, set up by Verdal. And what is the story behind it? Verdal had been called by the Pope to go to Rome to become a cardinal. And not everybody was happy with this, Verdal becoming a cardinal. The Pope, it was said, wasn't making him a cardinal because he deserved it. Oh no, he was making him a cardinal because he needed him on a crusade against the Turks, and he wanted to make sure that the Knights of Malta would be on his side. So bribe them with a cardinalate and have them on your side. The dean of the College of Cardinals was Cardinal Colonna, who was the one who was the most disaffected with the Verdals becoming a cardinal. So, according to protocol, the dean of the cardinals had to give a dinner for the new cardinal. And Colonna, a wily old, what you call it, invited Verdal for this dinner with all the senior cardinals. And very pointedly, throughout the dinner, had a wolf cub under his shoes. He stayed with this wolf under his shoes, showing his contempt for the wolf, because Verdala was the wolf. And Verdala was not one to forgive or forget. The moment he came to Malta, he ordered this column to be built so that he could see it every day from the window. It's just across there. And the column has the column, which is the coat of arms of the Colonna, and the wolf on it. The wolf is crapping on the column. And that remainder, Verdal made sure in his will to leave a substantial sum of money for the renovation of this column, because he wanted his vendetta to go on for years and years and years, and it did. So the grandmaster after Verdal was from Martino Garzes, who was known mostly for the Garza's Towers, again, a rather well-mannered grandmaster. But just before, or shortly before he became grandmaster, he had another of these not very well-explained criminal prosecutions against him. He was accused and convicted for beating a married woman with the hilt of his sword, breaking the hilt of his sword and her jaw. Pretty vicious. He was, the records emphasize a married woman, which opens vistas of why he was beating up this married woman. But that's as far as it goes. He spent 2 months in jail, and he was ordered never to approach this woman again. Vasconcellos, another grandmaster who was only grandmaster for a very short time, was also involved in crimes of violence before he was elected Grand Master. There are at least two criminal prosecutions against him. One was for using weapons against other knights, and what was more serious was the fact that the Grand Master ordered him to reconcile himself with the other knight with whom he had had this armed clash, and Vasconcellos refused. Never will I ever make peace with this other knight. He was placed under house arrest, and then traces of this episode seemed to fade away. But later on, he was again arraigned for taking part in a duel. Now, the knights were very ambivalent about duels. There are huge amount of evidence of duels. There is evidence of a duel fought inside the palace itself, on the doorstep of the palace. I won't go into that. But Vasconcellos was second in a duel which ended very badly. And of course, he was persecuted. Because although the knights belonged to an ethos of honor, honor has always to be vindicated. And as I said before, if the state does not take up the defense of your honor, you had to do it yourself. And one of the ways to do it was exactly by dueling. That explains why there are so many, many records of duels. Officially, dueling was considered to be a crime. And in fact, depending on the times and depending on the Grand Masters, there are many prosecutions which ended with expulsion from the order or with jail terms for knights who took part in duels. Antoine de Paul. Antoine de Paul was the 13th Grand Master in Malta. And maybe that explains why he's so unlucky with his chroniclers. Antoine de Paul was again a very old man, old by my standards. And he was besotted by this Flaminia Valenti. Flaminia Valenti, according to Fabio Chigi, who later became Pope and who was inquisitor in Malta, and kept Rome very much adjourned, informed about what was going on. In fact, a lot of this material which I'm quoting comes from the secret reports sent by inquisitors, usually very accurate and quite dispassionate. But Fabio Chigi had an uphill struggle with De Paul. He simply wouldn't give up this Flaminia Valenti. I think it's Chigi who uses the word besotted by this common prostitute. And yes, to the point that when it was clear that De Paul was in his last hours, Chigi pleaded with him to send her away, but De Paul wanted to die in her arms. Very touching, but I mean, monastic-wise, it's not exactly what the... So, Chigi wrote these very alarmed reports to Rome about this bothering old fool who couldn't do without Flaminia. And being a clever man, he was quite a good diplomat, De Paul. He had come to an arrangement with a confessor to absolve him of his sins. And he chose the right confessor. It was Fra Giovanni Bertolotti. Incidentally, the crypt of Tabarclot in St. John is named after him. Bertolotti was a very scandalous priest. He himself had a number of daughters. He himself, who he brazenly took up the altar when they got married. And De Paul thought it convenient to confess his sins with Don Giovanni Bertolotto. And he absolved him. But eventually, Chigi reported to Rome his little victory. Flaminia was not present when the Grandmaster actually passed away. That was not the end of Flaminia Valenti. When she found herself without a protector, according to Kijia, I'll read his little... She tried to charm the following grandmaster, Lascaris. She tried, in the words of Kijia, the future Pope Alexander VII, she tried hard to dominate him, Lascaris, through hypocrisy, as she had dominated the previous grandmaster through sensuality. And then she disappears. I believe I read somewhere, but I'm not saying this with great authority, that she entered a nunnery. Nunnery at that time didn't mean vocation. It was the place, the refuge for old prostitutes and for old for people who had somehow deviated. Not, of course, not all nunneries. I don't want to be misunderstood. There were nunneries of the Repentite, which was a nunnery to try to recuperate previous prostitutes. So the next Grand Master was the most austere of them all, Lascaris. Lascaris was, in fact, a very rigid, austere disciplinarian. But in his younger days, there is a little story about him. Every convent had a protector, had a knight. Every convent of nuns had one knight delegated to take care of the needs of these nuns. And when Lascaris was young, he was appointed as protector of one of the female convents in Malta. And some builders who were building across the road over the convent could oversee what was going on inside the convent. And they reported Lascaris. They said, he's flirting outrageously with them. We were scandalized to see him groping and throwing eggs full of flour at these young novices, as the young nuns. Well, that's about all that results, because after that, he became a very serious, very lugubrious grandmaster, to the point that to this day, there is a Maltese phrase which we use, which Lascari. I don't believe that is the explanation, but that is the common explanation. I believe that the Maltese remember Witch Lascari for a different reason, not because he was particularly ugly or because he was particularly severe. I believe that the reason is that Lascaris was the first grandmaster to put his face, his portrait, on coins. Before that, there had never been, in very olden times. But in the Maltese period, he was the first one to have. So everybody had Witch Lascari in his pocket. And possibly that is the reason why we use the word Witch Lascari, not because he was particularly unbecoming. Nicholas Cottoner was a great grandmaster. He was a lavish patron of the arts, St. John, Mattia Preti, and he was a very devout man, which means that he went through his religious duties very, very seriously. He attended church, he said his prayers, he was a pious, devout man. But Inquisitor Ranuzzi noted disconsolately in one of his secret messages to Rome, he said, ah, yes, that he is a very pious man. But, quote, his habit of frequenting prostitutes in his younger days has not abated at all in his old age. So even Lascaris had the schizophrenia of being able to cope with heaven and what is the opposite of heaven. One thing about Cottoner, which is sweet, is that by his time, the big balcony here around the palace had been built. And one observer said, oh, that's a godsend for Lascaris, because he passes long hours going around the balcony on the two squares, seeing who's talking to who, and knowing what alliances and what disalliances were being discussed. Because if he saw a knight frequently talking to X, then he knew that an alliance would be coming up between that knight and the others. And Cotoner went around from his observatory here, convened in the very first closed balcony mold. I have no doubt about that. There weren't any closed balconies before this balcony of this corner here. And he used it for good political advantage. After another grandmaster, the last one of the non-wigged grandmasters was Adrian de Wignacourt, not Alof. There's nothing about Alof. He seems to have been a pretty straight guy. But Adrian de Wignacourt has this story, pretty well documented, not by the Inquisitor, but by other sources. Adrian de Wignacourt was one of those knights who regularly took advantage of the departure of the galleons, of the vessels of the order. All the sailors, all the mariners, used to leave their wives and their daughters behind here, and Adrian de Wignacourt was one of those who routinely took advantage of the fact that the husband was away, so the knights were at play. And one day, a ship returned in advance. The husband came home. Wignacourt was quite horizontal at the time, and he had to jump out of a window to escape the anger of this husband. And he remembered this. And one of the very first laws that Adrian de Wignacourt passed, regulations, was twofold. That ships had to fire a cannonball coming into the harbor so that everyone would know, too, that besides this cannonball, no mariner was allowed to disembark if the ship arrived at before daybreak, to give good fair warning to whoever found himself in the same situation with his pants down. Perellos was the grandmaster, was the first grandmaster to wear a wig. And so by that time, things had changed quite a lot. Perellos was unashamedly a great womanizer. Even in his old age, I think he died in about 90s, whatever it was, it is recorded that he always was flirting with pretty women. He had coffee mornings virtually every day just for women, where he served them chocolate, doused himself in very loud perfume, and chatted with them, always taking the sides against their husbands. The chronicler says that they always reported how horrible their husbands were, and Perellos always took their sides. Perellos had noticeably two major mistresses. The first one was known officially as Donna Florinda, but her real name was Madame Moutet. And Madame Moutet, probably of French origin, was his established mistress for a long, long time. And until eventually he ditched her because he took a fancy to a much younger girl, and he ditched Madame Moutet. But he ditched her as a gentleman should. He gave her and her family, which this diarist calls Gran Canalia, her family, she was of very low extraction, and when he sent her away, or when she was no longer his mistress, he gave her property, he gave titles and jobs to all her family, and that way kept this Gran Canalia quiet. And then he took on himself another young mistress, a very young girl, who he placed across the palace, in a house just across the palace here. This girl also was very well kept. He wasn't stingy with her at all, although he had a reputation of being terribly stingy in other things, Perellas, to the point that, for example, the Grand Masters were always subscribers to the broadsheets of Europe to know what was going on. There was no telegraph there, no. So what they did was to buy the broadsheets which were published in the principal capitals of Europe to keep themselves informed on what was going on in Europe. And Perellos thought it was austerity measure to cancel all the subscriptions. But the Congress says, but he always borrowed them for free from other people. And, well, Perellos had this new girlfriend, which people manipulated, because it is said, it is written, that anybody who wanted, really wanted a favor from the Grand Master, had better go through her, probably paying her a little thing on the side, so that she would plead their cause with the Grand Master. When he was with Madame Mutet, it was pretty shocking, because the bishop himself tried to dissuade him from giving public scandal, and Perellos ignored him. And the bishop eventually wrote to Rome saying, this is a terrible scandal, our Grand Master flirting around with this low-class person. And the Pope actually ordered Perellos to give her up, just as obviously Perellos ignored him. The end is rather tragic, because Perellos contracted syphilis, terrible disease, which could only be cured, sort of, by the mercury treatment. And the mercury treatment, whether it cured or not, is questionable, but whether it harmed the body is not questionable at all. And many people who had the mercury treatment then suffered from the side effects of the mercury poisoning. Well, Perellos died at an old age, according to one letter writer, through an excess of mercury, because he had had the treatment so often that eventually his constitution couldn't take it anymore, and eventually he died, not through syphilis, but through excess of mercury. Mrs. Mutet, according to one of our historians, Robert Attard, gave rise to the phrase, it's Maltese, sorry for our English visitors here, colla mutetti. Colla mutetti means a person who's full of airs, who's full of affectations. That is a possible explanation. I always believe the real explanation is more mundane than that. I think it's just a corruption of the Italian tutta mossette. In Italian, mossette means being affected, being full of little stylized gestures. But it is a possibility that she gave birth to this phrase in Maltese, which we still use today, like we use Wichlaskri and we use colla mutetti. He must have been very keen on her. Perellos must have been very keen on her. Because again, there is another episode reported that when a knight tried to be funny with Mrs. Mutet, he had him imprisoned, tortured, and exiled. So this canaglia must have meant quite a lot to Perellos. Big Grand Master Villena. Villena was, again, a doer. A lot of what we see around has his coat of arms, and his name is very, very rightly remembered with great pride. Again, we don't know much about him, but one of the chaplains of the order certain Fra Giovanni Francesco Farrugia, for reasons of conscience or for reasons of spite or of vendetta, wrote to the Pope accusing Grandmaster Villena for his scandalous, abominable, and incestuous life. True? Spite? We don't know. What we know is that Villena never forgave him. He threw him without trial into a guva for life. He was condemned to stay in a guva for life. All attempts to have him reprieved failed, and he was only freed after Villena died, 11 years later, by Grandmaster Pinto. He spent 11 years in the guva for having had the audacity to report the Grandmaster for his incestuous life. Emmanuel Pinto. Pinto is Malta's answer to Silvio You-Know-Who. Pinto lived to a very old age, but throughout his life he was known to be a very, very lascivious person. Before he became grandmaster, he had a stable relationship with certain Signora Paolucci, and when he became grandmaster, he shunted her into a convent. But he always kept her in luxury and lavishly, although she was in a convent. Whether he didn't want to create scandal or because he had set his eyes on other pastors, I don't know, but it's certain that Paolucci ended up in a convent. But after that, it was one long, non-stop story of getting the best entertainment he could. And he was brazen about it. For example, in the Manuel Theatre, the stall, the box next to the Grandmaster's box was officially reserved for his mistresses, his Beniamine. They were called his Beniamine. According to Ovid Doublet, who I shall return to later, Pinto died actually making love to his mistress. Ovid Doublet was the secretary of the next Grand Master, and he knew a lot of what was going on here in this palace here. Now, I find this a bit difficult to believe, I don't know. I mean, Pinto was 92 at the time, and if he really died making love to his mistress, I think the monument is here. He deserves a much larger monument than the one he has. But there are many stories about Pinto. One of them relates to this room here. You know, in Malta, one of the favorite pastimes was the Cucania. The Cucania was a popular festival held in a square here on special occasions, St. John's, Vittoria. The Cucania was a trellis, a very high trellis, at an angle, with prices hung at the top of the trellis, and at a sign, all the young men would try to climb this trellis and grab these prices which were hanging at the top of the trellis. And these prices were generally foodstuffs, capons, chickens, hams, fruit, whatever. And it was a popular feast. Sometimes people got injured because there was a scramble to reach the top, and sometimes they fell and they went up again. Well, Carrasi was a French order, an anonymous French order, who didn't like the order, says with great detail that this cucania was repeated in this room here when all the doors were locked and the competitors stripped stark naked and went up the trellis to catch the prices which were gold objects, gold and silver objects. And he says that the Grand Master watched this lascivious spectacle in the company of other knights, few selected knights, and he says, the orgies that followed were indescribable. Believe or not. Anyway, it was the bunga bunga of that era. And the Doublet describes in very short, I think I'll read his exact words, what he says. Right up to his death, which caught him in flagrante, he was a model of the most scurrilous and libertine behavior, with women of very little decency. Many members of the order of all grades followed his example. Such excessive behavior caused many honest Maltese to be unjustly exiled from the country simply because they had the misfortune of being married to an attractive lady who happened to be the object of desire of some or other shameless knight. So here we have Grandmaster Pinto, who was also a great doer. He was an egomaniac. He certainly had a very high opinion of himself, very easily proved by the fact that he closed the crown into a crown. Before, it was always an open crown, which meant that it was a crown which was not top-notch. It was not the full sovereignty. While Pinto, for the first time, without authorization or consent of anybody, started using the closed crown, which means total sovereignty. He was, I feel a bit mean to say, because he was a great grandmaster, undoubtedly. He was the person who, probably in his time, the order was financially at its top, economically. Poverty had more or less abated in Malta, but good old Pinto was certainly responsible for that with his very autocratic ways. The next Grand Master was Ximenes. Ximenes was, again, a greyish figure, not very beloved by the Maltese, and he was not particularly known for any great virtue or great vice. But curiously, the rebel Don Gaetano Mannarino, who didn't like the order at all and was preparing a campaign to destabilize the order, one of the things he did, Don Gaetano Mannarino, was to compile a list of all the senior knights of the order who were living in open concubinage. Top of the list, he put Ximenes. We're coming to the end of the list of the Grand Masters. Deroan. Deroan was a good, kindly man, not a very strong person, but basically a decent fellow. And he's remembered for having had two mistresses. One of them was the wife of his French surgeon, Creni. They were French, they were Cren, but in Malta they became Creni. And he had an affair with Mrs. Creni, Anna Maria Creni. And he had a child by her, who was Antonia Creni. The doctor knew that it wasn't his child, but he very kindly accepted to bring her up as his child. This Antonia Creni features later. For reasons unknown but easy to guess, she became a great hater of the order. She became a Republican, a revolutionary, and it is recorded that the moment Napoleon landed in Malta, the very first visit was to that vile prostitute, Antonia Crini. Why Napoleon thought that he should visit Antonia Crini before anybody else, the daughter of the former Grand Master de Rohan, it is not known. But it is certainly recorded that this Antonia Crini later joined the revolutionaries. She was very much pro-French. Being the disowned daughter of a Grand Master would explain why she had developed this sort of hate rapport with the order of her father. Probably because the moment her father died, the next Grand Master, Hompesh, put her aside, didn't give her the kudos that she had received being the daughter of the former Grand Master. But very touching is the another story, which is, again, is very well documented. I find it a bit difficult to comprehend. The story goes that de Rohan fell in love with his very young niece, Anne d'Amigny, the daughter of his younger brother. He was 40 years older than her, and he seems to have lost his head about this niece of his. They're supposed to have lived openly as husband and wife. There must be something in the story, because the second part of the story is that she died in the British period. Anne d'Amigny died in the British period. And there is good evidence. I don't say that it is evidence that would stand up beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law, but there is very good evidence that when she died, Maitland, who by then had been governor of Malta, ordered her to be buried in de Rohan's tomb. The tomb was opened at night, and this young, no longer young girl, was buried at the feet of the Grand Master, and she's supposed to be buried there. There's plenty of, as I said, indicative evidence that this is a true story. Last Grand Master, Hompesh, it's the last one anyway. Hompesh was a very unfortunate person. He was not a person of great merits, but he was very beloved by the Maltese. He spoke Maltese perfectly. He knew Maltese so well that it is recorded that when he met a Maltese, he would say, "You're from this village, you're from that village, you're from that village." His ear was so tuned to the various nuances of the dialects that he knew where they came from. Hompesh too had his mistress. It was a Maltese for once. Not for once, she was a Maltese girl, Natalia Farrugia, who he kept discreet in the countryside. He visited her regularly, and she was the last mistress of the last Grand Master.
You have just listened to a talk in the series Rediscovering the Grand Master's Palace, entitled Deeds and Misdeeds at the Palace. This talk was delivered by Judge Giovanni Bonello and was organized by the Office of the President.